and disputed. In the one is a passive, though a voluntary obedience. In the other, an independence scornful of experience and jealous of authority. These two tendencies, apparently so discrepant, are far from conflicting. They advance together and mutually support each other. Religion perceives that civil liberty affords a noble exercise to the faculties of man, and that the political world is a field prepared by the Creator for the efforts of the intelligence. Contented with the freedom and the power which it enjoys in its own sphere, and with the place which it occupies, the empire of religion is never more surely established than when it reigns in the hearts of men unsupported by aught beside its native strength. Religion is no less the companion of liberty in all its battles and its triumphs, the cradle of its infancy and the divine source of its claims. The safeguard of morality is religion, and morality is the best security of law and the surest pledge of freedom. See Appendix F. Reasons of certain anomalies which the laws and customs of the Anglo-Americans present. The reader is cautioned not to draw too general or too absolute an inference from what has been said. The social condition, the religion, and the manners of the first emigrants undoubtedly exercised an immense influence on the destiny of their new country. Nevertheless, they were not in a situation to found a state of things solely dependent on themselves. No man can entirely shake off the influence of the past, and the settlers, intentionally or involuntarily, mingled habits and notions derived from their education and from the traditions of their country with those habits and notions which were exclusively their own. To form a judgment on the Anglo-Americans of the present day, it is therefore necessary to distinguish what is of Puritanical and what is of English origin. Laws and customs are frequently to be met with in the United States which contrast strongly with all that surrounds them. These laws seem to be drawn up in a spirit contrary to the prevailing tenor of the American legislation, and these customs are no less opposed to the tone of society. If the English colonies had been founded in an age of darkness, or if their origin was already lost in the lapse of years, the problem would be insoluble. I shall quote a single example to illustrate what I advance. The civil and criminal procedure of the Americans has only two means of action: committal and bail. The first measure taken by the magistrate is to exact security from the defendant, or, in case of refusal, to incarcerate him. The ground of the accusation and the importance of the charges against him are then discussed. It is evident that a legislation of this kind is hostile to the poor man and favorable only to the rich. The poor man has not always a security to produce, even in a civil case. And if he is obliged to wait for justice in prison, he is speedily reduced to distress. The wealthy individual, on the contrary, always escapes imprisonment in civil causes. Nay, more, he may readily elude the punishment which awaits him for a delinquency by breaking his bail, so that all the penalties of the law are, for him, reducible to fines. Author's note: crimes no doubt exist for which bail is inadmissible, but they are few in number. Nothing can be more aristocratic than this system of legislation. Yet, in America, it is the poor who make the law, and they usually reserve the greatest social advantages to themselves. The explanation of the phenomenon is to be found in England. The laws of which I speak are English, and the Americans have retained them, however repugnant they may be to the tenor of their legislation and the mass of their ideas. Next to its habits, the thing which a nation is least apt to change is its civil legislation. Civil laws are only familiarly known to legal men, whose direct interest it is to maintain them as they are, whether good or bad, simply because they themselves are conversant with them. The body of the nation is scarcely acquainted with them. It merely perceives their action in particular cases. But it has some difficulty in seizing their tendency and obeys them without premeditation. I have quoted one instance where it would have been easy to adduce a great number of others. The surface of American society is, if I may use the expression, covered with a layer of democracy, from beneath which the old aristocratic colors sometimes peep. Chapter 3. Social Conditions of the Anglo-Americans. The striking characteristic of the social condition of the Anglo-Americans in its essential democracy. Many important observations suggest themselves upon the social condition of the Anglo-Americans, but there is one which takes precedence of all the rest. The social condition of the Americans is eminently democratic. This was its character at the foundation of the colonies, and is still more strongly marked at the present day. I have stated in the preceding chapter that great equality existed among the emigrants who settled on the shores of New England. The germ of aristocracy was never planted in that part of the Union. The only influence which obtained there was that of intellect. The people were used to reverence certain names as the emblems of knowledge and virtue. Some of their fellow citizens acquired a power over the rest which might truly have been called aristocratic, if it had been capable of transmission from father to son. This was the state of things to the east of the Hudson. To the southwest of that river, and in the direction of the Floridas, the case was different. In most of the states situated to the southwest of the Hudson, some great English proprietors had settled, who had imported with them aristocratic principles and the English law of descent. I have explained the reasons why it was impossible ever to establish a powerful aristocracy in America. These reasons existed with less force to the southwest of the Hudson. In the south, one man, aided by slaves, could cultivate a great extent of the country. It was therefore common to see rich landed proprietors. But their influence was not altogether aristocratic, as that term is understood in Europe, since they possessed no privileges. And the cultivation of their estates being carried on by slaves, they had no tenants depending on them, and consequently no patronage. Still, the great proprietors south of the Hudson constituted a superior class, having ideas and tastes of its own, and forming the center of political action. This kind of aristocracy sympathized with the body of the people, whose passions and interests it easily embraced. But it was too weak and too short-lived to excite either love or hatred for itself. This was the class which headed the insurrection in the South, and furnished the best leaders of the American Revolution. In the period of which we are now speaking, society was shaken to its center. The people, in whose name the struggle had taken place, conceived the desire of exercising the authority which it had acquired. Its democratic tendencies were awakened, and having thrown off the yoke of the mother country, it aspired to independence of every kind. The influence of individuals gradually ceased to be felt, and custom and law united together to produce the same result. But the law of descent was the last step to equality. I am surprised that ancient and modern jurists have not attributed to this law a greater influence on human affairs. Author's note: I understand by the law of descent all those laws whose principal object is to regulate the distribution of property after the death of its owner. The law of entail is of this number. It certainly prevents the owner from disposing of his possessions before his death, but this is solely with the view of preserving them entire for their heir. The principal object, therefore, of the law of entail is to regulate the descent of property after the death of its owner. Its other provisions are merely means to this end. It is true that these laws belong to civil affairs, but they ought nevertheless to be placed at the head of all political institutions. For whilst political laws are only the symbol of a nation's condition, they exercise an incredible influence upon its social state. They have, moreover, a sure and uniform manner of operating upon society, affecting, as it were, generations yet unborn. Through their means, man acquires a kind of preternatural power over the future lot of his fellow creatures. When the legislator has regulated the laws of inheritance, he may rest from his labor. The machine, once put in motion, will go on for ages, and advance, as if self-guided, towards a given point. When framed in a particular manner, this law unites, draws together, and vests property and power in a few hands. Its tendency is clearly aristocratic. On opposite principles, its action is still more rapid. It divides, distributes, and disperses both property and power. Alarmed by the rapidity of its progress, Those who despair of arresting its motion endeavor to obstruct it by difficulties and impediments. They vainly seek to counteract its effect by contrary efforts, but it gradually reduces or destroys every obstacle, until by its incessant activity the bulwarks of the influence of wealth are ground down to the fine and shifting sand, which is the basis of democracy. When the law of inheritance permits, still more when it decrees, the equal division of a father's property amongst all his children, its effects are of two kinds. It is important to distinguish them from each other, although they tend to the same end. In the virtue of the law of partible inheritance, the death of every proprietor brings about a kind of revolution in property. Not only do his possessions change hands, but their very nature is altered, since they are parceled into shares, which become smaller and smaller at each division. This is the direct and, as it were, the physical effect of the law. It follows, then, that in countries where equality of inheritance is established by law, property, and especially landed property, must have a tendency to perpetual diminution. The effects, however, of such legislation would only be perceptible after a lapse of time, if the law was abandoned to its own working. For supposing the family to consist of two children, and in a country people, as France, as the average number is not above three, these children, sharing amongst them the fortune of both parents, would not be poorer than their father or mother. But the law of equal division exercises its influence not merely upon the property itself, but it affects the minds of the heirs and brings their passions into play. These indirect consequences tend powerfully to the destruction of large fortunes, and especially of large domains. Among nations whose law of descent is founded upon the right of primogeniture, landed estates often pass from generation to generation without undergoing division, the consequence of which is that family feeling is to a certain degree incorporated with the estate. The family represents the estate the family, whose name, together with its origin, its glory, its power, and its virtues, is thus perpetuated and an imperishable memorial of the past and a sure pledge of the future. When the equal partition of property is established by law, the intimate connection is destroyed between family feeling and the preservation of the paternal estate. The property ceases to represent the family, for as it must inevitably be divided after one or two generations, it has evidently a constant tendency to diminish, and must in the end be completely dispersed. The sons of the great landed proprietor, if they are few in number, or if fortune befriends them, may indeed entertain the hope of being as wealthy as their father, but not that of possessing the same property as he did. The riches must necessarily be composed of elements different from his. Now, from the moment that you divest the landowner of that interest in the preservation of his estate, which he derives from association, from tradition, and from family pride, you may be certain that sooner or later he will dispose of it. For there is a strong pecuniary interest in favor of selling, as floating capital produces higher interest than real property, and is more readily available to gratify the passions of the moment. Great landed estates which have once been divided never come together again, for the small proprietor draws from his land a better revenue in proportion than the large owner does from his, and of course he sells it at a higher rate. Author's note: I do not mean to say that the small proprietor cultivates his land better, but he cultivates it with more ardor and care, so that he makes up by his labor for his want of skill. The calculations of gain, therefore, which decide the rich man to sell his domain, will still more powerfully influence him against buying small estates to unite them into a large one. What is called family pride is often founded upon an illusion of self-love. A man wishes to perpetuate and immortalize himself, as it were, in his great-grandchildren. Where the esprit de famille ceases to act, individual selfishness comes into play. When the idea of family becomes vague, indeterminate, and uncertain, a man thinks of his present convenience. He provides for the establishment of his succeeding generation, and no more. Either a man gives up the idea of perpetuating his family, or at any rate he seeks to accomplish it by other means than that of a landed estate. Thus, not only does the law of partible inheritance render it difficult for families to preserve their ancestral domains entire, but it deprives them of the inclination to attempt it, and compels them in some measure to cooperate with the law in their own extinction. The law of equal distribution proceeds by two methods. By acting upon things, it acts upon persons. By influencing persons, it affects things. By these means, the law succeeds in striking at the root of landed property and dispersing rapidly both families and fortunes. Author's note: land being the most stable kind of property, we find from time to time rich individuals who are disposed to make great sacrifices in order to obtain it, and who willingly forfeit a considerable part of their income to make sure of the rest. But these are accidental cases. The preference for landed property is no longer found habitually in any class but among the poor. The small landowner, who has less information, less imagination, and fewer passions than the great one, is generally occupied with the desire of increasing his estate, and it often happens that by inheritance, by marriage, or by the chances of trade, he is gradually furnished with the means. Thus, to balance the tendency which leads men to divide their estates, there exists another which incites them to add to them. This tendency, which is sufficient to prevent estates from being divided ad infinitum, is not strong enough to create great territorial possessions, certainly not to keep them up in the same family. Most certainly it is not for us Frenchmen of the 19th century, who daily witness the political and social changes which the law of partition is bringing to pass, to question its influence. It is perpetually conspicuous in our country, overthrowing the walls of our dwellings and removing the landmarks of our fields. But although it has produced great effects in France, much still remains for it to do. Our recollections, opinions, and habits present powerful obstacles to its progress. In the United States, it has nearly completed its work of destruction, and there we can best study its results. The English laws concerning the transmission of property were abolished in almost all the states at the time of the Revolution. The law of entail was so modified as not to interrupt the free circulation of property. See Appendix G. The first generation having passed away, estates began to be parceled out, and the change became more and more rapid with the progress of time. At this moment, after a lapse of a little more than 60 years, the aspect of society is totally altered. The families of the great landed proprietors are almost all commingled with the general mass. In the state of New York, which formerly contained many of these, there are but two who still keep their heads above the stream, and they must shortly disappear. The sons of these opulent citizens are become merchants, lawyers, or physicians. Most of them have lapsed into obscurity. The last trace of hereditary ranks and distinctions is destroyed. The law of partition has reduced all to one level. I do not mean that there is any deficiency of wealthy individuals in the United States. I know of no country, indeed, where the love of money has taken stronger hold on the affections of men, and where the profounder contempt is expressed for the theory of the permanent equality of property. But wealth circulates with inconceivable rapidity, and experience shows that it is rare to find two succeeding generations in the full enjoyment of it. This picture, which may perhaps be thought to be overcharged, still gives a very imperfect idea of what is taking place in the new states of the West and Southwest. At the end of the last century, a few bold adventurers began to penetrate into the valleys of the Mississippi, and the mass of the population very soon began to move in that direction. Communities unheard of till then were seen to emerge from the wilds. States whose names were not in existence a few years before claimed their place in the American Union. And in the Western settlements, we may behold democracy arrived at its utmost extreme. In these states, founded offhand and, as it were, by chance, the inhabitants are but of yesterday. Scarcely known to one another, the nearest neighbors are ignorant of each other's history. In this part of the American continent, therefore, the population has not experienced the influence of great names and great wealth, nor even that of the natural aristocracy of knowledge and virtue. None are there to wield that respectable power which men willingly grant to the remembrance of a life spent in doing good before their eyes. The new states of the West are already inhabited, but society has no existence among them. It is not only the fortunes of men which are equal in America, even their requirements partake in some degree of the same uniformity. I do not believe that there is a country in the world where, in proportion to the population, there are so few uninstructed and at the same time so few learned individuals. Primary instruction is within the reach of everybody. Superior instruction is scarcely to be obtained by any. This is not surprising. It is, in fact, the necessary consequence of what we have advanced earlier. Almost all the Americans are in easy circumstances and can therefore obtain the first elements of human knowledge. In America, there are comparatively few who are rich enough to live without a profession. Every profession requires an apprenticeship, which limits the time of instruction to the early years of life. At 15, they enter upon their calling, and thus their education ends at the age when ours begins. Whatever is done afterwards is with a view to some special and lucrative object. A science is taken up as a matter of business, and the only branch of it which is attended to is such as admits of an immediate practical application. In America, most of the rich men were formerly poor. Most of those who now enjoy leisure were absorbed in business during their youth. The consequence of which is that when they might have had a taste for study, they had no time for it, and when time is at their disposal, they have no longer the inclination. There is no class, then, in America in which the taste for intellectual pleasures is transmitted with hereditary fortune and leisure, and by which the labors of the intellect are held in honor. Accordingly, there is an equal want of the desire and the power of application to these objects. A middle standard is fixed in America for human knowledge. All approach as near to it as they can, some as they rise, others as they descend. Of course, an immense multitude of persons are to be found who entertain the same number of ideas on religion, history, science, political economy, legislation, and government. The gifts of intellect proceed directly from God, and man cannot prevent their unequal distribution. But in consequence of the state of things which we have here represented, it happens that, although the capacities of men are widely different, as the Creator has doubtless intended they should be, they are submitted to the same method of treatment. In America, the aristocratic element has always been feeble from its birth, and if at the present day it is not actually destroyed, it is at any rate so completely disabled that we can scarcely assign to it any degree of influence in the course of affairs. The democratic principle, on the contrary, has gained so much strength by time, by events, and by legislation, as to have become not only predominant. There is no family or corporate authority, and it is rare to find even the influence of individual character enjoy any durability. America, then, exhibits in her social state a most extraordinary phenomenon. Men are there seen on a greater equality in point of fortune and intellect, or, in other words, more equal in their strength than in any other country of the world, or in any age of which history has preserved the remembrance. Political consequences of the social condition of the Anglo-Americans. The political consequences of such a social condition as this are easily deducible. It is impossible to believe that equality will not eventually find its way into the political world as it does everywhere else. To conceive of men remaining forever unequal upon one single point, yet equal on all others, is impossible. They must come in the end to be equal upon all. Now I know of only two methods of establishing equality in the political world. Every citizen must be put in possession of his rights, or rights must be granted to no one. For nations which are arrived at the same stage of social existence as the Anglo-Americans, it is therefore very difficult to discover a medium between the sovereignty of all and the absolute power of one man, and it would be vain to deny that the social condition which I have been describing is equally liable to each of these consequences. There is, in fact, a manly and lawful passion for equality which excites men to wish all to be powerful and honored. This passion tends to elevate the humble to the rank of the great. But there exists also in the human heart a depraved taste for equality, which impels the weak to attempt to lower the powerful to their own level, and reduces men to prefer equality in slavery to inequality with freedom. Not that those nations whose social condition is democratic naturally despise liberty. On the contrary, they have an instinctive love of it. But liberty is not the chief and constant object of their desires. Equality is their idol. They make rapid and sudden efforts to obtain liberty, and if they miss their aim, resign themselves to their disappointment. But nothing can satisfy them except equality, and rather than lose it, they resolve to perish. On the other hand, in a state where the citizens are nearly on an equality, it becomes difficult for them to preserve their independence against the aggressions of power. No one among them being strong enough to engage in the struggle with advantage, nothing but a general combination can protect their liberty, and such a union is not always to be found. From the same social position, then, nations may derive one or the other of two great political results. These results are extremely different from each other, but they may both proceed from the same cause. The Anglo-Americans are the first nation who, having been exposed to this formidable alternative, have been happy enough to escape the dominion of absolute power. They have been allowed by their circumstances, their origin, their intelligence, and especially by their moral feeling, to establish and maintain the sovereignty of the people. Chapter 4. The Principle of the Sovereignty of the People in America. Whenever the political laws of the United States are to be discussed, it is with the doctrine of the sovereignty of the people that we must begin. The principle of the sovereignty of the people, which is to be found more or less at the bottom of almost all human institutions, generally remains concealed from view. It is obeyed without being recognized, or if for a moment it be brought to light, it is hastily cast back into the gloom of the sanctuary. The will of the nation is one of those expressions which have been most profusely abused by the wily and despotic of every age. To the eyes of some, it has been represented by the venal suffrages of a few of the satellites of power, to others by the votes of a timid or an interested minority, and some have even discovered it in the silence of a people, on the supposition that the fact of submission established the right of command. In America, the principle of the sovereignty of the people is not either barren or concealed, as it is with some other nations. It is recognized by the customs and proclaimed by the laws. It spreads freely and arrives without impediment at its most remote consequences. If there be a country in the world where the doctrine of the sovereignty of the people can be fairly appreciated, where it can be studied in its application to the affairs of society, and where its dangers and its advantages may be foreseen, that country is assuredly America. I have already observed that, from their origin, the sovereignty of the people was the fundamental principle of the greater number of British colonies in America. It was far, however, from then exercising as much influence on the government of society as it now does. Two obstacles, the one external, the other internal, checked its invasive progress. It could not ostensibly disclose itself in the laws of colonies which were still constrained to obey the mother country. It was therefore obliged to spread secretly and to gain ground in the provincial assemblies and especially in the townships. American society was not yet prepared to adopt it with all its consequences. The intelligence of New England and the wealth of the country to the south of the Hudson, as I have shown in the preceding chapter, long exercised a sort of aristocratic influence, which tended to retain the exercise of social authority in the hands of a few. The public functionaries were not universally elected, and the citizens were not all of them electors. The electoral franchise was everywhere placed within certain limits and made dependent on a certain qualification, which was exceedingly low in the North and more considerable in the South. The American Revolution broke out, and the doctrine of the sovereignty of the people, which had been nurtured in the townships and municipalities, took possession of the state. Every class was enlisted in its cause. Battles were fought, and victories obtained for it, until it became the law of laws. A no less rapid change was effected in the interior of society, where the law of descent completed the abolition of local influences. At the very time when this consequence of the laws and the revolution was apparent to every eye, victory was irrevocably pronounced in favor of the democratic cause. All power was, in fact, in its hands, and resistance was no longer possible. The higher orders submitted without a murmur and without a struggle to an evil which was thenceforth inevitable. The ordinary fate of falling powers awaited them. Each of their several members followed his own interests. And as it was impossible to wring the power from the hands of a people which they did not detest sufficiently to brave, their only aim was to secure its goodwill at any price. The most democratic laws were consequently voted by the very men whose interests they impaired. And thus, although the higher classes did not excite the passions of the people against their order, they accelerated the triumph of the new state of things. So that by a singular change, the democratic impulse was found to be most irresistible in the very states where the aristocracy had the firmest hold. The state of Maryland, which had been founded by men of rank, was the first to proclaim universal suffrage and to introduce the most democratic forms into the conduct of its government. When a nation modifies the elective qualification, it may easily be foreseen that sooner or later that qualification will be entirely abolished. There is no more invariable rule in the history of society. The further electoral rights are extended, the greater is the need of extending them. For after each concession, the strength of the democracy increases, and its demands increase with its strength. The ambition of those who are below the appointed rate is irritated in exact proportion to the great number of those who are above it. The exception at last becomes the rule. Concession follows concession, and no stop can be made short of universal suffrage. At the present day, the principle of the sovereignty of the people has acquired, in the United States, all the practical development which the imagination can conceive. It is unencumbered by those fictions which have been thrown over it in other countries, and it appears in every possible form according to the exigency of the occasion. Sometimes the laws are made by the people in a body, as at Athens, and sometimes its representatives, chosen by universal suffrage, transact business in its name and almost under its immediate control. In some countries, a power exists which, though it is in a degree foreign to the social body, directs it and forces it to pursue a certain track. In others, the ruling force is divided, being partly within and partly without the ranks of the people. But nothing of the kind is to be seen in the United States. There, society governs itself for itself. All power centers in its bosom, and scarcely an individual is to be met with who would venture to conceive, or still less, to express the idea of seeking it elsewhere. The nation participates in the making of its laws by the choice of its legislators, and in the execution of them by the choice of the agents of the executive government. It may almost be said to govern itself, so feeble and so restricted is the share left to the administration. So little do the authorities forget their popular origin and the power from which they emanate. See Appendix H. Chapter 5. Necessity of examining the condition of the states before that of the Union at large. It is proposed to examine in the following chapter what is the form of government established in America on the principle of the sovereignty of the people. What are its resources, its hindrances, its advantages, and its dangers. The first difficulty which presents itself arises from the complex nature of the Constitution of the United States, which consists of two distinct social structures, connected and, as it were, encased one within the other. Two governments, completely separate and almost independent, the one fulfilling the ordinary duties and responding to the daily and indefinite calls of a community, the other circumscribed within certain limits, and only exercising an exceptional authority over the general interests of the country. In short, there are 24 small sovereign nations whose agglomeration constitutes the body of the Union. To examine the Union before we have studied the states would be to adopt a method filled with obstacles. The form of the federal government of the United States was the last which was adopted, and it is in fact nothing more than a modification or a summary of those republican principles which were current in the whole community before it existed, and independently of its existence. Moreover, the federal government is, as I have just observed, the exception. The government of the states is the rule. The author who should attempt to exhibit the picture as a whole before he had explained its details would necessarily fall into obscurity and repetition. The great political principles which govern American society at this day undoubtedly took their origin and their growth in the state. It is therefore necessary to become acquainted with the state in order to possess a clue to the remainder. The states which at present compose the American Union all present the same features, as far as regards the external aspect of their institutions. Their political or administrative existence is centered in three focuses of action, which may not inaptly be compared to the different nervous centers which convey motion to the human body. The township is the lowest in order, then the county, and lastly, the state, and I propose to devote the following chapter to the examination of these three divisions. The American System of Townships and Municipal Bodies. It is not undesignedly that I begin this subject with the township. The village or township is the only association which is so perfectly natural that wherever a number of men are collected, it seems to constitute itself. The town, or tithing, as the smallest division of a community, must necessarily exist in all nations, whatever their laws and customs may be. If a man makes monarchies and establishes republics, the first association of mankind seems constituted by the hand of God. But although the existence of the township is coeval with that of man, its liberties are not the less rarely respected and easily destroyed. A nation is always able to establish great political assemblies, because it habitually contains a certain number of individuals fitted by their talents, if not by their habits, for the direction of affairs. The township is, on the contrary, composed of coarser materials, which are less easily fashioned by the legislator. The difficulties which attend the consolidation of its independence rather augment than diminish with the increasing enlightenment of the people. A highly civilized community spurns the attempts of a local independence, is disgusted at the numerous blunders, and is apt to despair of success before the experiment is completed. Again, no immunities are so ill protected from the encroachments of the supreme power as those of municipal bodies in general. They are unable to struggle, single-handed, against a strong or an enterprising government, and they cannot defend their cause with success unless it be identified with the customs of the nation and supported by public opinion. Thus, until the independence of townships is amalgamated with the manners of a people, it is easily destroyed, and it is only after a long existence in the laws that it can be thus amalgamated. Municipal freedom is not the fruit of human device. It is rarely created, but it is, as it were, secretly and spontaneously engendered in the midst of a semi-barbarous state of society. The constant action of the laws and the national habits, peculiar circumstances, and above all, time, may consolidate it. But there is certainly no nation on the continent of Europe which has experienced its advantages. Nevertheless, local assemblies of citizens constitute the strength of free nations. Town meetings are to liberty what primary schools are to science. They bring it within the people's reach. They teach men how to use and how to enjoy it. A nation may establish a system of free government, but without the spirit of municipal institutions, it cannot have the spirit of liberty. The transient passions and the interests of an hour, or the chance of circumstances, may have created the external forms of independence, but the despotic tendency which has been repelled will, sooner or later, inevitably reappear on the surface. In order to explain to the reader the general principles on which the political organization of the counties and townships of the United States rests, I have thought it expedient to choose one of the states of New England as an example, to examine the mechanism of its constitution, and then to cast a general glance over the country. The township and the county are not organized in the same manner in every part of the Union. It is, however, easy to perceive that the same principles have guided the formation of both of them throughout the Union. I am inclined to believe that these principles have been carried further in New England than elsewhere, and consequently that they offer greater facilities to the observations of a stranger. The institutions of New England form a complete and regular whole. They have received the sanction of time, they have the support of the laws, and the still stronger support of the manners of the community, over which they exercise the most prodigious influence. They consequently deserve our attention on every account. Limits of the Township. The Township of New England is a division which stands between the commune and the canton of France, and which corresponds in general to the English tithing, or town. Its average population is from 2,000 to 3,000, so that, on the one hand, the interests of its inhabitants are not likely to conflict, and, on the other, men capable of conducting its affairs are always found to be among its citizens. Author's note: in 1830 there were 305 townships in the state of Massachusetts, and 610,014 inhabitants, which gives an average of about 2,000 inhabitants to each township. Authorities of the Township in New England. In the township, as well as everywhere else, the people is the only source of power. But in no stage of government does the body of citizens exercise a more immediate influence. In America, the people is a master whose exigencies demand obedience to the utmost limits of possibility. In New England, the majority acts by representatives in the conduct of the public business of the state. But if such an arrangement be necessary in general affairs, in the townships, where the legislative and administrative action of the government is in more immediate contact with the subject, the system of representation is not adopted. There is no corporation, but the body of electors, after having designated its magistrates, directs them in everything that exceeds the simple and ordinary executive business of the state. Author's note: the same rules are not applicable to the great towns, which generally have a mayor and a corporation divided into two bodies. This, however, is an exception which requires the sanction of a law. See the Act of February 22, 1822, for appointing the authorities of the city of Boston. It frequently happens that small towns as well as cities are subject to a peculiar administration. In 1832, 104 townships in the state of New York were governed in this manner. This state of things is so contrary to our ideas and so different from our customs that it is necessary for me to adduce some examples to explain it thoroughly. The public duties in the township are extremely numerous and minutely divided, as we shall see further on. But the larger proportion of administrative power is vested in the hands of a small number of individuals, called the selectmen. Author's note: three selectmen are appointed in the small townships and 9 in the larger ones. The general laws of the state impose a certain number of obligations on the selectmen, which they may fulfill without the authorization of the body they represent, but which they can only neglect on their own responsibility. The law of the state obliges them, for instance, to draw up the list of electors in their townships, and if they omit this part of their functions, they are guilty of a misdemeanor. In all the affairs, however, which are determined by the town meeting, the selectmen are the organs of the popular mandate, as in France, the mayor executes the decree of the municipal council. They usually act upon their own responsibility and merely put in practice principles which have been previously recognized by the majority. But if any change is to be introduced in the existing state of things, or if they wish to undertake any new enterprise, they are obliged to refer to the source of their power. If, for instance, a school is to be established, the selectmen convoke the whole body of the electors on a certain day at an appointed place. They explain the urgency of the case. They give their opinion on the means of satisfying it, on the probable expense, and the site which seems to be most favorable. The meeting is consulted on these several points, It adopts the principal, marks out the site, votes the rate, and confides the execution of its resolution to the selectmen. The selectmen have alone the right of calling a town meeting, but they may be requested to do so. If 10 citizens are desirous of submitting a new project to the assent of the township, they may demand a general convocation of the inhabitants. The selectmen are obliged to comply, but they have only the right of presiding at the meeting. The selectmen are elected every year in the month of April or of May. The town meeting chooses at the same time a number of other municipal magistrates who are entrusted with important administrative functions. The assessors rate the township. The collectors receive the rate. A constable is appointed to keep the peace, to watch the streets, and to forward the execution of the laws. The town clerk records all the town votes, orders, grants, births, deaths, and marriages. The treasurer keeps the funds. The overseer of the poor performs the difficult task of superintending the action of the poor laws. Committeemen are appointed to attend to the schools and to public instruction. And the road surveyors, who take care of the greater and lesser thoroughfares of the township, complete the list of the principal functionaries. They are, however, still further subdivided, and amongst the municipal officers are to be found parish commissioners who audit the expenses of public worship, different classes of inspectors, some of whom are to direct the citizens in case of fire, tithing men, listers, haywards, chimney viewers, fence viewers to maintain the bounds of property, timber measurers, and sealers of weights and measures. There are 19 principal officers in a township. Every inhabitant is constrained, on the pain of being fined, to undertake these different functions, which, however, are almost all paid, in order that the poor citizens may be able to give up their time without loss. In general, the American system is not to grant a fixed salary to its functionaries. Every service has its price, and they are remunerated in proportion to what they have done. Existence of the township. I have already observed that the principle of the sovereignty of the people governs the whole political system of the Anglo-Americans. Every page of this book will afford new instances of the same doctrine. In the nations by which the sovereignty of the people is recognized, every individual possesses an equal share of power and participates alike in the government of the state. Every individual is, therefore, supposed to be as well informed, as virtuous, and as strong as any of his fellow citizens. He obeys the government, not because he is inferior to the authorities which conduct it, or that he is less capable than his neighbor of governing himself, but because he acknowledges the utility of an association with his fellow men, and because he knows that no such association can exist without a regulating force. If he be a subject in all that concerns the mutual relations of citizens, he is free and responsible to God alone for all that concerns himself. Hence arises the maxim that everyone is the best and the sole judge of his own private interest, and that society has no right to control a man's actions, unless they are prejudicial to the common weal, or unless the common weal demands his cooperation. This doctrine is universally admitted in the United States. I shall hereafter examine the general influence which it exercises on the ordinary actions of life. I am now speaking of the nature of municipal bodies. The township, taken as a whole and in relation to the government of the country, may be looked upon as an individual to whom the theory I have just alluded to is applied. Municipal independence is therefore a natural consequence of the principle of the sovereignty of the people in the United States. All the American republics recognize it more or less. But circumstances have peculiarly favored its growth in New England. In this part of the Union, the impulsion of political activity was given in the townships, and it may almost be said that each of them originally formed an independent nation. When the kings of England asserted their supremacy, they were contented to assume the central power of the state. The townships of New England remained as they were before, and although they are now subject to the state, they were at first scarcely dependent upon it. It is important to remember that they have not been invested with privileges, but that they have, on the contrary, forfeited a portion of their independence to the state. The townships are only subordinate to the state in those interests which I shall term social, as they are common to all the citizens. They are independent in all that concerns themselves, and amongst the inhabitants of New England, I believe that not a man is to be found who would acknowledge that the state has any right to interfere in their local interests. The towns of New England buy and sell, sue or are sued, augment or diminish their rates without the slightest opposition on the part of the administrative authority of the state. They are bound, however, to comply with the demands of the community. If the state is in need of money, a town can neither give nor withhold the supplies. If the state projects a road, the township cannot refuse to let it cross its territory. If a police regulation is made by the state, it must be enforced by the town. A uniform system of instruction is organized all over the country, and every town is bound to establish the schools which the law ordains. In speaking of the administration of the United States, I shall have occasion to point out the means by which the townships are compelled to obey in these different cases. I here merely show the existence of the obligation. Strict as this obligation is, the government of the state imposes it in principle only, and in its performance the township resumes all its independent rights. Thus, taxes are voted by the state, but they are levied and collected by the township. The existence of a school is obligatory, but the township builds, pays, and superintends it. In France, the state collector receives the local imposts. In America, the town collector receives the taxes of the state. Thus, the French government lends its agents to the commune. In America, the township is the agent of the government. This fact alone shows the extent of the differences which exist between the two nations. Public spirit of the townships of New England. In America, not only do municipal bodies exist, but they are kept alive and supported by public spirit. The township of New England possesses two advantages which infallibly secure the attentive interest of mankind, namely, independence and authority. Its sphere is indeed small and limited, but within that sphere its action is unrestrained, and its independence gives to it a real importance which its extent and population may not always ensure. It is to be remembered that the affections of men generally lie on the side of authority. Patriotism is not durable in a conquered nation. The New Englander is attached to his township, not only because he was born in it, but because it constitutes a social body of which he is a member, and whose government claims and deserves the exercise of his sagacity. In Europe, the absence of local public spirit is a frequent subject of regret to those who are in power. Everyone agrees that there is no surer guarantee of order and tranquility, and yet nothing is more difficult to create. If the municipal bodies were made powerful and independent, the authorities of the nation might be disunited and the peace of the country endangered. Yet, without power and independence, a town may contain good subjects, but it can have no active citizens. Another important fact is that the township of New England is so constituted as to excite the warmest of human affections, without arousing the ambitious passions of the heart of man. The officers of the country are not elected, and their authority is very limited. Even the state is only a second-rate community, whose tranquil and obscure administration offers no inducement sufficient to draw men away from the circle of their interests into the turmoil of public affairs. The federal government confers power and honor on the men who conduct it, but these individuals can never be very numerous. The high station of the presidency can only be reached at an advanced period of life, and the other federal functionaries are generally men who have been favored by fortune or distinguished in some other career. Such cannot be the permanent aim of the ambitious, but the township serves as a center for the desire of public esteem, the want of exciting interests, and the taste for authority and popularity in the midst of the ordinary relations of life. And the passions which commonly embroil society change their character when they find a vent so near the domestic hearth and the family circle. In the American states, power has been disseminated with the admirable skill for the purpose of interesting the greatest possible number of persons in the common weal. independently of the electors who are from time to time called into action, the body politic is divided into innumerable functionaries and officers, who all, in their several spheres, represent the same powerful whole in whose name they act. The local administration thus affords an unfailing source of profit and interest to a vast number of individuals. The American system, which divides the local authority among so many citizens, does not scruple to multiply the functions of the town officers. For in the United States it is believed, and with truth, that patriotism is a kind of devotion which is strengthened by ritual observance. In this manner, the activity of the township is continually perceptible. It is daily manifested in the fulfillment of a duty or the exercise of a right, and a constant, though gentle, motion is thus kept up in society, which animates without disturbing it. The American attaches himself to his home, as the mountaineer clings to his hills, because the characteristic features of his country are there more distinctly marked than anywhere else. The existence of the townships of New England is in general a happy one. Their government is suited to their tastes and chosen by themselves. In the midst of the profound peace and general comfort which reign in America, the commotions of municipal discord are unfrequent. The conduct of local business is easy. The political education of the people has long been complete, say rather that it was complete when the people first set foot upon the soil. In New England, no tradition exists of a distinction of ranks. No portion of the community is tempted to oppress the remainder, and the abuses which may injure isolated individuals are forgotten in the general contentment which prevails. If the government is defective, and it would no doubt be easy to point out its deficiencies, the fact that it really emanates from those it governs, and that it acts either ill or well, casts the protecting spell of a parental pride over its faults. No term of comparison disturbs the satisfaction of the citizen. England formerly governed the mass of the colonies, but the people was always sovereign in the township, where its rule is not only an ancient but a primitive state. The native of New England is attached to his township because it is independent and free. His cooperation in its affairs ensures his attachment to its interest. The well-being it affords him secures his affection, and its welfare is the aim of his ambition and of his future exertions. He takes a part in every occurrence in the place. He practices the art of government in the small sphere within his reach. He accustoms himself to those forms which can alone ensure the steady progress of liberty. He imbibes their spirit. He acquires a taste for order, comprehends the union or the balance of powers, and collects clear practical notions on the nature of his duties and the extent of his rights. The counties of New England. The division of the counties in America has considerable analogy with that of the arrondissement of France. The limits of the counties are arbitrarily laid down, and the various districts which they contain have no necessary connection, no common tradition or natural sympathy. Their object is simply to facilitate the administration of justice. The extent of the township was too small to contain a system of judicial institutions. Each county has, however, a court of justice, a sheriff to execute its decrees, and a prison for criminals. There are certain wants which are felt alike by all the townships of a county. It is therefore natural that they should be satisfied by a central authority. In the state of Massachusetts, this authority is vested in the hands of several magistrates, who are appointed by the governor of the state, with the advice of his council. Author's note: the council of the governor is an elective body. The officers of the county have only a limited and occasional authority, which is applicable to certain predetermined cases. The state and the townships possess all the power requisite to conduct public business. The budget of the county is drawn up by its officers, and is voted by the legislature, but there is no assembly which directly or indirectly represents the county. It has, therefore, properly speaking, no political existence. A twofold tendency may be discerned in the American constitutions, which impels the legislator to centralize the legislative and to disperse the executive power. The township of New England has in itself an indestructible element of independence, and this distinct existence could only be fictitiously introduced into the county, where its utility has not been felt. But all the townships united have but one representative, which is the state, the center of the national authority. Beyond the action of the township and that of the nation, nothing can be said to exist but the influence of individual exertion. Administration in New England. There is nothing more striking to an European traveler in the United States than the absence of what we term the government or the administration. Written laws exist in America, and one sees that they are daily executed. But although everything is in motion, the hand which gives the impulse to the social machine can nowhere be discovered. Nevertheless, as all peoples are obliged to have recourse to certain grammatical forms, which are the foundation of human language, in order to express their thoughts, so all communities are obliged to secure their existence by submitting to a certain dose of authority, without which they fall a prey to anarchy. This authority may be distributed in several ways, but it must always exist somewhere. There are two methods of diminishing the force of authority in a nation. The first is to weaken the supreme power in its very principle, by forbidding or preventing society from acting in its own defense under certain circumstances. To weaken authority in this manner is what is generally termed in Europe to lay the foundations of freedom. The second manner of diminishing the influence of authority does not consist in stripping society of any of its rights, nor in paralyzing its efforts, but in distributing the exercise of its privileges in various hands and in multiplying functionaries, to each of whom the degree of power necessary for him to perform his duty is entrusted. There may be nations whom this distribution of social powers might lead to anarchy, but in itself it is not anarchical. The action of authority is indeed thus rendered less irresistible and less perilous, but it is not totally suppressed. The revolution of the United States was the result of a mature and dignified taste for freedom, and not of a vague or ill-defined craving for independence. It contracted no alliance with the turbulent passions of anarchy, but its course was marked, on the contrary, by an attachment to whatever was lawful and orderly. It was never assumed in the United States that the citizen of a free country has a right to do whatever he pleases. On the contrary, social obligations were there imposed upon him more various than anywhere else. No idea was ever entertained of attacking the principles or of contesting the rights of society. But the exercise of its authority was divided, to the end that the office might be powerful and the officer insignificant, and that the community should at once be regulated and free. In no country in the world does the law hold so absolute a language as in America, and in no country is the right of applying it vested in so many hands. The administrative power in the United States represents nothing either central or hierarchical in its constitution, which accounts for its passing unperceived. The power exists, but its representative is not to be perceived. We have already seen that the independent townships of New England protect their own private interests, and the municipal magistrates are the persons to whom the execution of the laws of the state is most frequently entrusted. Author's note: I take one example in 1,000. The state prohibits traveling on the Sunday. The tithing men, who are town officers, are specially charged to keep watch and to execute the law. The selectmen draw up the lists of electors for the election of the governor and transmit the result of the ballot to the Secretary of the State.